Hi everybody, it's Keith Scott-Manby here again with another amazing discussion in the series, The Science of Being and Consciousness. This one has got to be unusual. You'll soon see what I mean when we start talking to my special guest. Tony Wright, for those of you who don't live in England or don't know England, he comes from Cornwall in the southwest corner, and they are, to put it politely, pretty rugged down there, pretty independent, and in fact, there's always constant movements that they should be an independent kingdom. Tony, what I didn't tell you last time I spoke is that my mother and sister live there. They've lived there for 30 years. We're not Cornish by origin, but they like the territory. They're not far from you in Newquay. I forgot to mention that. Anyway, Tony, my special guest, has got some amazing theories that dovetail very well with ideas that have excited me for decades now. And it's a completely different way of looking at things to what we've been doing. So let's get straight into this. Tony, welcome aboard.
Hello, Keith. Thanks thanks very much for having me on.
Okay, well, as you know, we're going to talk about consciousness and stuff. But why didn't you tell us your, you know, traditionally we start with the path. You know, I mean, how did you get there? What on earth took you from where you were to being a researcher in the field?
Indeed, good question. Well, it's going back about 20 years now, and I had no real great sort of vision or ambition to end up doing anything like this. I just happened to be a student at Edinburgh Botanic Gardens in Scotland, mostly studying sort of plants and plant sciences and related studies. And through a number of, I guess, coincidences, if that's how you want to see them, I ended up getting more interested in the human condition. So I sort of had some background in plant sciences and evolutionary theory, the classic Darwinian theory, and I began to get interested in what seemed to me to be gaps in the sort of traditional view of human origins, and particularly how it related to our current state of mind and perhaps some of the problems we're currently facing in terms of our health and also our perception, and these Arcadian traditions that talk about humanity perhaps not functioning as well as we may have done at one time. So those were kind of some of the clues I was confronted with about 20 years ago, and I just started digging around and eventually started doing some experiments myself, self-experimentation, and from that emerged the sort of embryonic idea that really there was perhaps a serious problem that we'd become blind to, and the problem was residing where all the tradition said it was, something to do with our mind, something in our head.
Right. Now, we're for the sake of clarity, for those who are listening and just joined us, let's be plain about this. We're going to talk about right and left brain and the influence that those have had historically. I mean, you've got some amazing theories on that. You could say, couldn't you, or people have said, that it's really like two separate cells, two identities running inside the same skull. In fact, you know, in some situations, it's even more than two identities. You know, it gets very, very confusing. But that's where we're coming from, isn't it? Now, I've got to tell you, Tony, that I would have liked Julian Jaynes to be part of this series. You know who he is. And he had a very interesting story. And I wonder if I could call on you to tell his story. I mean, I know it's not your story, but it's a fascinating idea. He came up with this bicameral mind thing, and that maybe way back in the distant past, we were hearing right brain messages that people interpreted as the voice of God or gods speaking to them. Do you want to kick off by describing his model? I know we're going to diverge from it, so don't worry, I'm not holding you to that model.
But sure, well, I did come across his work again some while ago, probably a good 15 years ago or more now. In fact, it might even have been about 20 years ago, not long after I got interested myself and began to realize that some of what I was working with fitted into the classic left-right brain ideas, although with a significant variation. And my understanding of his work, I mean, I don't profess to be any kind of expert, although I did read his book quite early on, but he seemed, or my interpretation is anyway, that he seemed to be talking, again, about the left and right side of the brain, and that some of the traditions that have come down to us and some of the functions, sort of more poetic way of looking at the world and even the way we communicate, were relics of more access to our, how we currently describe it, the right side of our brain, and including perhaps the way communication was conveyed in the way we describe things, or our ancestors describe voices of the gods and so on, as you mentioned. And he was basically sort of saying that from that almost perpetual semi-schizophrenic state emerged a more singular sense of self, a more modern and advanced, perhaps, as we currently, or most of us currently tend to think of it, sense of self, more dominated by the left side of our brain. So he was talking about more of a sort of cohabitation model, I think. That would be my interpretation. And that slowly dissolved. I think he was onto something. He was a bit short, perhaps, on mechanisms and why all this happened. And I personally think he was documenting to some degree what I would call the tail end of some kind of shared perspective or shared dominance. So I think he was partly correct, in my opinion, anyway. Though, again, I think the idea that we then emerged into perhaps a more functional or advanced state, we may have that back to front. So some parallels and some differences. But that's my understanding, very simplistically, of what he was trying to get across.
Yeah, I think the important point from his theories was that not that the right brain or left brain was actually necessarily better, and these voices from the right, I don't think he was saying they were better or worse, just simply that we hadn't connected, we hadn't twigged that it was us, that people thought it was a god. As you say, he was very short on mechanism, but he was very good on evidence. I mean, I think his evidence is extremely convincing. He found these inscriptions and carvings and statues where there was often a little god on the person's right shoulder whispering in their ear. So they were clearly getting sort of right-sided signals, according to this tradition. And that it was only about 3,000 years ago, give or take, when this started to disappear. And the carvings switched to being thrones of gods that were empty. Like, where are the gods? It's all gone.
Yes.
It's like mankind had become very puzzled. So it's a very persuasive argument, and it could be true. And it certainly doesn't not fit with, I think, with what you're going to tell us. We don't need to argue at this, in Julian Jayne's theory, whether the right brain was better or worse. It's just that it nobody had made the connection that it was really us anyway. So they called it gods. But anyway, so that's what we're going to be talking about, folks. Now, you've got a different take. And I've got to tell you, there's a slight warning, Tony. This idea that in the past it was all beautiful and golden and so on is a well-known psychological phenomenon. People believe it, even if you show them the statistics from, like more murders, more disease, more miserable states of life, they still believe the past was more perfect and heavenly.
Mm-hmm.
So, beware of that degree of skepticism. But your model is that the right brain is the good half and the left brain is the bad half. Do you want to explain how your version works? Well, there's a lot of physiology here. No, I don't expect you to do it all in one breath. But
sure, I'll try and sort of come up with some fairly straightforward explanations. But yeah, in some ways that's a little bit simple, although it certainly comes across like that. I'm certainly operating on a different timeline than even Julian Jayne's was. I'm looking at, perhaps the last quarter of a million years, which isn't such a huge time in evolutionary theory, but in terms of human history would be considered a very distant epoch, I guess. And what I've proposed really is that at one time, and this partly deals with your comments on the way we idealize the past, which I'm very familiar with, that is what we tend to do, but I don't think that precludes a very real possibility that there's something was very different in the past and may have been better. Obviously, it doesn't prove it was there as well. But looking at the evolutionary data, what I put together was an idea that our neural system developed very differently, particularly in the forest, and the sort of the classic specialized abilities that are currently ascribed to each hemisphere and are there to some degree in most neural systems, or most sort of higher organisms than neural systems. I propose that those differences were pretty much ironed out. They were smoothed over by a layer of neural tissue that really wasn't so much specialized. It had all the best of everything and was much more unified, worked as a singular system. And that was entirely dependent on an ongoing and evolving symbiotic relationship with the tropical forest, particularly, it's to do with diet, but diet tends to have too much baggage. So I'm really talking about the the biochemical input from the tropical forest and all the sort of hormonally active factors changed the way our brain developed, and we ended up with this very different system. So rather than it being that we were more right brain, we just had a singular system that worked very well and very differently, and obviously that affected our how we would perceive ourselves and all of our functions. So that's sort of going back to the origins, and then we've ended up, for reasons that I hope I can explain fairly clearly, we've ended up almost beginning to revert to type, where one side of our brain has reverted more quickly than the other. It's lost a lot of these, what might be termed highly advanced or certainly very unique functions, and that's the sort of dominant force in our existence now. We currently ascribe these traits to the left side of our brain, where there's some relic function remains in the right side of our brain. So it sort of ties in with the left-right brain ideas, but it's rather than talking about adaptation, I'm talking about a process of degeneration. It's really a diagnosis of a condition that I think was alluded to in virtually all the Arcadian mythology and spiritual traditions, and even where Julian James picks up the story, he's talking about a change where there were last glimpses of something that was difficult to understand and slowly disappeared altogether, and we're now left pretty much dominated by a conceptual worldview and of ourselves and how we communicate, and we tend to mistake that for reality. And again, the modern neurological data is very interesting when you look at it with these questions in mind.
Right. Now, a great part of your hypothesis, I mean, it's a very coherent hypothesis, but you need to explain it, is that diet changed brain size, and it has to do with hormonal inhibitions and so on. Can you, without making it too technical, can you talk us through that, Tony?
Sure. Again, I'll try and break it down as best I can. You're right, it's a very contextual model, and this is something I've been working on to try and explain it more simplistically. But again, it's back to these distant origins, which are well supported in the modern data and hinted at in some of the Arcadian mythology. Even I would say even the Genesis story, however real it is, certainly has some interesting elements when there's talk of living naked in a forest where fruit's available, which that can only be the tropical forest, the non-seasonal tropical forest. And the modern take on that's very similar. Our origins, tropical forest, East Africa somewhere. And we formed, again, well documented, we formed varying degrees of symbiotic relationship with the flowering plants. And that led to the co-evolution of fruit. The fruit expanded as part of the seed dissemination, the relationship where primates and other animals distribute the seeds. And this relationship became much more entangled and complicated as time went on. Now, people talk about the functional side of that, the seed dissemination and so on, but if you look at the biochemistry, there's a very unique element in this, and what we were really forming a relationship with was the sex organs of the plants, the flowers, and ultimately the fruit. And that's really extremely unusual, extremely rare. And of course, if you start ingesting, it's dietary, of course, if you start ingesting the sex organs of a whole other kingdom, let alone another species, you're flooding yourself with the developmental environment hormones, like in mammals and in humans we have steroids, we have estrogens and testosterone and a lot of secondary hormones that play a massive role in the transcription of DNA and in the reading of the blueprint, and that dictates the structure and therefore the function and so on. Well, if you start ingesting these chemicals from the plant kingdom, they're all evolved to read DNA, but of course they read it differently because the DNA molecule is pretty much the same in plants and animals, so it will respond to hormones, but of course it'll do different things. And a lot of these plant chemicals, these plant hormones, very significantly modify our own hormones, particularly the steroids, the testosterone estrogen complex, and tends to modify them in an inhibitory way, tends to dampen down their function. And also there are direct effects. These plant hormones will also effectively read our DNA. They'll do different things with the DNA. So we were becoming increasingly immersed in this confluence of complex biochemistry. And amongst other things, the mechanisms today look as if it would extend our juvenile period, for example. We wouldn't reach sexual maturity so quickly, which gives us a longer window to develop a larger brain. And what you end up with is a whole plethora of relatively large and relatively complex brains all linked to the tropical forest. Ours being no exception. But if it's a symbiotic relationship, it's of course interdependent. You end up effectively becoming a singular organism. You lose the individual mammal, you lose the individual primate and the trees that it's feeding on, and it becomes or at least anything that emerges from that relationship becomes a singular organism. So that's what I proposed is the mechanism driving the emergence of our unique neural system and ultimately giving rise to a very different state of mind and consciousness. And if there's ever a separation, if that relationship breaks down, of course there's going to be massive changes. Right. Part of what I proposed is our DNA, the mammalian DNA, really doesn't have the complexity to build very advanced, very complex neural systems generally. They're extremely rare. What we were borrowing, without perhaps realizing it now, we were borrowing the biochemistry and particularly the hormones from the tropical forest trees, particularly from their developmental environments. And that's what led to the rapid expansion and the very advanced neural architecture. Of course, since we've become disconnected, that's been eroding and reverting to type. So we've ended up with a progressively more primitive neural system to the point now, I'd say, in our current state, which this model, it's not just looking at the past, it's looking at the mess we're in, really. We've become blithely unaware of how dysfunctional our neural system is. We tend to talk about how advanced we are while ignoring the massive amount of evidence as to what we're doing to ourselves and the place we live. And I'd say it's a classic case of mental ill health. It's, you know, self-harm, which is a symptom of mental ill health. So I mean, that's a sort of brief overview, origins to current state, and saying something went seriously amiss due to this breakdown in our relationship with the forest.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay. So, I mean, we went a bit fast there. For some of the listeners, let's slow it down a minute. You're saying, I think, or correct me if I'm wrong, but that our diet at that time had critical chemicals that altered our hormonal structure. That'd be no surprise to people, and I think everybody now knows that soy isoflavones, for example, are not that good an idea.
Yes.
Soy does screw up human hormones, so plants can do that. So that's not a surprise. But what you're saying is it sufficiently inhibited our hormones that instead of maturing quickly like other animals, we develop slowly up till puberty, and that's when our brains grow, you know, that period up to puberty. So by extending the development period, we develop bigger brains, really, largely due to eating certain plants rather than, you know, typical theories, which are, you know, we got smarter, faster, and invented fire and tools.
Exactly.
And needed bigger brains.
Yes. Yes, it was more of what's currently called an epigenetic effect. It wasn't so much to do with our genome, our DNA, and classic selective adaptation. It was a direct effect of this relationship, which was in place for a very long time. You know, even the orthodox data suggests it went on for millions of years. And obviously within that relationship, there was an evolution of that symbiotic relationship. So yes, I think extending the juvenile window was a big factor, but also the very direct effects of this very rich chemical cocktail, an incredibly unique chemical cocktail. I mean, we all know the tropical forests are rich in biochemistry, but you pull all that together into the developmental environment and you're perhaps forming a relationship with 50, 100 different species. It's exceptionally rich in all these classes of hormones, neuroactive compounds, and so on. So it wasn't just the extending windows. I think that's a big factor. It was also the way the structure was developing. It was a very complex chemical transcription environment, developmental environment, and that was giving rise to unique cellular structure, subcellular structure, particularly in our neural system, which is very responsive to these things. And as I say, the idea is this was 24/7. Now, of course, the only place this can happen is the non-seasonal tropical forests, the only place you get fruit all year round for significant or even evolutionary timescales are these very small niches in the tropical forests.
Right.
If that was the home of our, or if that was our origins, our genesis, you'd expect to see clues in our physiology. For example, we'd be well adapted to that kind of environment. And the data seems to stack up very well. You know, we still retain these traits that suggest perhaps our origins or at least the origins of our intelligence and our big brain weren't the savanna. Other people have pointed out that really, it's a big struggle to make the savanna work because it's such an extreme environment. There's very little biochemistry there. There's very little to build a big brain with. It's very hostile. However, the non-seasonal tropical forests are very benign, both climatically. It's constantly mild and warm and wet. And there's very few large predators there. So there's a lot of things that do make sense. It's just a model that nobody's really looked at into recent times, at least. It's always been presumed that we had to get out of the forest to become smart.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
You make it sound like the womb, you know, warm and wet and safe. Sorry, go on.
That's a good analogy, and I think the tropical forest is womb-like, and then, as I say, quite literally, we were feasting on and ingesting what is the equivalent of the plant kingdom's womb. You know, it's the fruit is effectively, as I say, most of us know fruit is something to eat, maybe it's something healthy to eat, but really it's the plant's equivalent of the uterus or the womb, and that's a very unusual symbiotic relationship.
Do you think our ancestors were running around tripping, Tony, you know, this chemical feast? Do you think that's maybe where consciousness woke up, as it were?
I would go as far as saying I suspect, of course I don't know, but I suspect that their normal state of mind, remember, what we consider normal may in fact be heavily altered by the loss of all these chemicals, but their normal state of mind would be what we would currently describe today as a very altered state of mind, the kind of states of mind that people do access through things like meditation or the traditional use of plant chemicals, which isn't a surprise, of course, because if we've lost all these plant chemicals, then it's perhaps not surprising we are very susceptible to drug use and misuse. But clearly there are still living traditions where people use various approaches very safely. And they do report an incredibly different state of mind that might be described as tripping, but perhaps we've got it back to front. Maybe our current state is more like a really bad trip.
Yeah, the mind boggles, actually, at the idea of our ancestors running around on a permanent high. But, of course, they would have had limited knowledge of biology and things like that and botany, so it would maybe just a normal to them, is what you're saying. They would go around eating things like psilocybin and other sort of vegetable-based compounds and be high, but not know any other way. It's only when you've been taken off you actually come down. Is this what you're saying?
Sure, I don't think they would have been ingesting specific things to trip in the way that some...
No, I don't mean deliberately. I mean inadvertently, yeah. As part of this very...
Well, inadvertently,
time.
Yes. I think it was just normal, but I would probably say things like... I mean, obviously, people have proposed theories on psilocybin playing a role in our emergence, our consciousness emergence, and so on. I would say these things came later as palliative attempts to try and redress, rather than using one very powerful chemical or alkaloid, which tends to be the case today. That was an attempt to replace perhaps certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of perhaps milder but still neuroactive chemicals that were present 24/7. I think they were perpetually in a very different state of mind, which again, although it's not proof, but it's interesting that we have this tradition handed down to us suggesting exactly that our normal state of our very distant ancestors, I'm obviously not talking the last few thousand years, was radically different, almost too difficult to describe. And there was this degeneration, which again is echoed in all these myths, and slowly something different emerged, and eventually it became dominant, and it's the dominant theme is what we recognize as ourselves today. But it's not talked about in a positive way. It's talked about a regression or a move towards a more primitive state of mind. So yes, I think these states were perpetual. They were normal and of a much higher order than it's easy for us to even imagine today. I use the analogy, it's quite harsh, but it's as if we currently suffer from a form of dementia, and because we all have it, our reference points, you know, are fairly close to each other. Some people are a little bit different to others, but generally we're all in the same sort of state. And then people report glimpses, whether it be through judicious use of neurochemical analogues, sort of likes of psilocybin and so on, or through techniques, or occasionally spontaneously, and they're actually at a loss for words, but what they do manage to convey is remarkably similar, regardless of culture, regardless of history, or whatever. There's clearly some wiring left somewhere that sounds pretty damned amazing, to be honest. It's not a state that you wouldn't want to be in for as long as you possibly could.
Yeah. Well, you've got a sympathetic audience here, Tony. I don't think any of the listeners on this call think that brain is being. You know, we are not our brain.
No.
That leads us in the wrong direction of thinking, as you point out in your book, that, you know, it gives the idea that we're all islands because we're all different brains. All that's nonsense.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, that is a good point to clear up. Although I do use a lot of modern neurological talk, I try and be as clear as I can that I regard our neural system, which, phenomenally complex though it is, I see it as no more than a musical instrument, and our beingness is the music that it, not even that it plays, that it taps into, more like perhaps a television set or a radio, or a bit like the lens in a telescope, and in its phenomenal structure, it can somehow focus this otherness, and I don't profess to come up with any ideas as to what that otherness is. It's just who we really are, and we mistake the mechanisms that facilitate that these days for who we are, when in fact we're really tapping into this much greater sense of self. Obviously sounds a little bit fluffy, but I think the mechanisms are there. They do.
Well, it's almost a sense of not self, isn't it? I mean, people often say they lose self, or, you know, their specific identity. They tend to merge.
That's another way to describe it. I think the sort of state of no mind, or the losing the sense of self. But I would say that is in regard to our normal sense of who we are. I think beyond that, well beyond that, there is an effort to allude to a different sense of self, but it's not an individual sense of self. It's a it's a very universal, very, again, the descriptions that I've come across and the brief glimpses I've perhaps managed to sort of bring about by various techniques, it always seems to be the same, but it's phenomenally amazing. It feels amazing, you know, talking about, I mean, being permanently high. Well, some of these states seem to be, they make our reference points for what we normally feel somewhat worrying. I often wonder, well, on a good day, are we just slightly less depressed than normal, and we mistake that for feeling good? And when you've had experiences with these other states, it's like it puts everything else in perspective. It changes everything forever. And these things are reported, you know, I'm sure you well know, they've been reported throughout history. They're still reported today. It's fascinating they exist at all, and why on earth we have this latent capacity to feel so much better, and not only feeling so much better, but it can bring with it powerful insights, a totally different way of looking at things, a totally different way of solving problems. And of course, there's connections with immune function and the ability to deal with very difficult diseases and pathologies and so on. So it seems like there's a wholly different system locked away in there, and it's somehow tied to a different self. And of course, it might seem too simplistic to talk about left and right brain. And I know, you know, in perhaps the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of dismissal of the very simplistic interpretation. But I tend to think something very simple has been missed within that as well. When you look at the data on the left and right side of the brain, there's some really, really good data.
I want this from you in a minute. That's what you're here for, so I've held you back from that as long as I could.
Okay, well,
while we do the background, but of course that's what you want to say. Let me just put one point in before we move on from what you were saying. I mean, what you're describing is this wonderful state of advanced consciousness and being. I remind you, or the listeners, of the words of Gurdjieff, who said the biggest barrier to consciousness is the belief you're already conscious. You're saying, and I agree, that, you know, everybody's fast asleep. They're like in a zombie-like state, and they only occasionally wake up. It's this wake-up state that's exciting, isn't it? So go on, tell us, on your model, Tony, what do you think has gone wrong? The left brain has screwed all this up. I'd have to ask you why, you know, what physiological process may the left brain have gone through. But first of all, explain how you think it's screwing things up, and then how you think it came about. And then perhaps the third question is, what can we do about it?
Sure, of course. The whole point of this is, what can we do about it? I'm not really interested in pointing out the pathology if there's no solutions. But yeah, this is really an attempt at a diagnosis, very holistic diagnosis. And I'd like to think it's simple at its core, but there is a lot of data around it. And really, I don't think so much the left brain has screwed things up per se in any other way than anybody with classic mental ill health problems simply acts out of the limits of their function. You know, if we were to visit a classic Victorian insane asylum, we wouldn't be too shocked to see people rocking backwards and forwards on chairs, harming themselves, harming each other, and there would be no blame. It would just be, well, they're clearly not very well. And I think all that's happened is back to this Arcadian past where we formed this connection, our ancestors and our relatives formed by degrees, of course, the degrees of specialization, but we formed this relationship, and we started off with a split brain. One side was slightly different to the other, but, you know, very useful for adaptive purposes, for survival. So there was always a genetic variation between each side of the brain, not so much, but just enough. And that's what I'm proposing initially got ironed out by this perpetual and evolving relationship with fruit, the plant's developmental organs. When that broke down, because there was this built-in genetic asymmetry, one side being slightly different to the other, as this process went into reverse, there was a reversion and erosion. One side was always going to be affected more quickly than the other. It could have been the right side. It just happened to be the left, and it looks like it's been more susceptible more quickly to this loss of biochemistry, and it's reverted to type, or it's been reverting to type much more quickly than the right side of the brain. I think they've both been affected. I'm not saying the right brain's intact at all. I just think it's the last relics of our true essence, our humanity, and so on. Whereas the left brain's reverted to a much more standard mammalian brain type. It's lacking much empathy. It's lacking much compassion. It's not too bright, although it likes to think it is, and so on. And it's in a bizarre twist. And again, back to Julian Jayne's work, and I probably agree roughly with the timeline. It's taken perceptual control somewhere in the last, well, 5,000 to 10,000 years anyway. And once it's running the show, that's where the problem really lies. It's like electing the least sighted person to drive the bus on a very dangerous road. Well, of course, you're going to end up in a lot of crashes, and there's going to be a lot of problems. So we're really effectively being run by the least functional side of our brain, while it's absolutely certain it's the most functional side, which is what you get. You know, it's exactly what you get with mental ill health. So I think in terms of the left brain being a problem, yes, it is a problem, but it's not bloody-minded. It's not doing this because it knows. It just doesn't know any better. It's only doing what it would do. It's much more primitive now, and it's much more into competition and control. It's very frightened, and that's what's governing all of us to some degree. And then because there's a variation in the symptomology, some people are more left brain dominant than others, you end up with this kind of what emerges in society is the people with the least functional left brains, because they're more frightened, they end up aspiring to take control. So you get the emergence of the patriarchal and hierarchical systems. And you end up, again, with the least functional people in charge. And we all know this. We all talk about this. I'm saying there's a neurological basis to this, and there should be evidence. I can't get away with this if there's not evidence. Well, again, once you start looking at the data is very compelling. But what you have to be very careful of is the interpretation of the data, because we're all running to some degree on our left brain. So the data's talking about delusion and all sorts of problems associated with perception and relatively poor cognitive functions. And then it comes up with these splendid explanations. Well, this is specialized adaptation, and we need this, and it's really good the left brain's in charge. But of course, it's self-assessment. It's telling itself that it's really the best thing since, well, I'd say sliced bread, but that doesn't really fit here. So yeah, it's not so much demonizing the left brain. It's really saying it's simply more affected, more afflicted, and it's ended up in charge. And we need to address that, of course, and we need to convince our own left brains that actually there's a problem here.
Right. Well, you talked down a little bit, you know, the left brain, you were quite critical of it, I think, in a book, but there's no question that you're a dog of the right brain. So go on, launch us into that. I know all these amazing abilities that human beings are capable of, without question, come from the right brain. I mean, it's...
Sure, well, I'm sure I am critical.
We get all our emotions from there, and we could do without some of those. So it's not...
I think that is the place where the relics of our humanity still live, and of course, where very few people are totally left-brained, or of course, and incredibly rarely right-brained. So we're always drawing on our right brain, even in this current state. I mean, I focus a lot on the left brain in isolation, simply to highlight its traits. But these traits do get diluted because the two hemispheres do still cooperate to some degree. And that is, as you say, that's where we draw our emotions from. Of course, these are all labels, they're all concepts. So whatever that experience is, we call emotions. And then we have things like creativity and artistic ability and poetry. But beyond that, and again, coming out of split brain research and the data on autistic savants and so on, we have phenomenal skills and abilities, and they always seem to correlate with getting access to the right brain, never ever the other way around. I've yet to come across a case where somebody suffered significant damage to their right brain and it's released amazing abilities. It's always damage to the left brain, if there is any evidence of damage. Sometimes it's difficult to find the evidence, but where there is evidence, it's always damage to the left brain, and that can release function in the right brain. And it's not compensation, as some people seem to think for a while. I mean, compensation is roughly like for like. It might be slightly different. The functions that can emerge are often off the scale better. You know, eidetic memory, where people can remember everything forever. They have no possibility of forgetting it. And a lot of the savant syndrome cases demonstrate phenomenal memory, photographic memory, phenomenal artistic ability, where people can just take a look at an incredibly complex landscape just for a second, and then they can reproduce it in perfect scale and proportion and so on and so forth. Similar with music, that's where perfect pitch lives. It's clearly not in our left brain, because if it was, we'd all have it. You know, there's some very simplistic things here. If these abilities and skills were part of our dominant hemisphere's palette of skills, we demonstrate them. Well, they're very rare, and when we do get access, either spontaneously or people who have more sustained access, the data is very compelling. They don't live in the left side of our brain. So what on earth are we doing with the capacity for not something slightly better, but phenomenally better, locked away? Why is it locked away? Why do we even need techniques? Why do we need to meditate? Why do we need to take neurochemical cocktails to stimulate these things? Or are these just treatments for a failing system where, again, we're now we've been usurped by the side of a brain that clearly doesn't have these abilities? So yeah, I think there is a whole palette of things in there, including a different kind of immune function, which I've already alluded to. There's a strong case to be made that a lot of traditional approaches to human health or unhealth was simply to induce an altered state, and that would take care of it. Well, what on earth's going on there? What on earth's wrong with the immune system when it's being run by the left brain? And so on and so on. So, a lot of possibilities locked away in our right brain, very well documented. And when you start putting them all together, there isn't anything that we currently can do in our normal left brain state that we couldn't do 50, 100, 1,000 times better if we could find a way to permanently access these latent abilities.
Right. Now, I know you got involved in some personal research I'd like you to share with us. One way of trying to tackle this is to selectively shut down the left brain, isn't it? And we know that sleep deprivation can do that. Can you explain to us what you did? Because the results are pretty interesting, to say the least. I'm talking about the Manchester experiment, right?
Right, yes. Well, as I say, you know, going back about 20 years, I got interested in all of this, and I started to look at what people had been doing to access. You know, at the time, I was quite skeptical. I mean, clearly, I'm fairly convinced by my own argument, and I know that's dangerous, so I'm hoping other people are going to scrutinize this, but... I did begin to look at what people were doing to get into these states, or what happened when they reported these states, and there seemed to be a common pattern. There were these ancient traditions, some of which I've touched on, classic ones being things like meditation or the kind of Trappist approach, not speaking, more Vision Quest, some of these traditions are still alive. Again, it can rely on cocktails of certain groups of chemicals which seem to asymmetrically stimulate the right hemisphere more than the left. And then there was this tradition of staying awake for long periods, either it was sometimes under the guise of prolonged meditation. I think the tradition of the Buddha's enlightenment was tied in with meditating for 6 or 7 days under the Bodhi tree. Well, again, people talk about meditation, but unless you've fallen asleep, that's prolonged sleep deprivation. Then right. There's the sort of North American traditions, again, where people would stay awake for 3, 4, 5 days waiting for the vision to come, much more visual view of things, much more coherent view.
That turns up in shamanic training, doesn't it? Can I just say something there, Tony? That turns up in shamanic training, the deprivation.
Yes.
I mean, food and, you know, food deprivation as well as sleep.
Yes.
In one of my books, I told an amazing story of a guy who was walled up in an ice house for 30 days. This was an Eskimo from the far north.
All right.
And I knew it.
Yeah.
And he had his vision, exactly as you say, his vision, his right brain vision eventually came. But what was absolutely stunning about this story is that what he dreamed of was a blonde white woman. He'd never seen such a thing and didn't know such a thing even existed.
Well,
I mean, most of us, when we go to sleep, probably tend to dream of blonde white women. But why Eskimos? You know, we've seen them in real life. That's what I mean. So,
That's
a very important part of spiritual training, isn't it, to sleep deprivation?
Well, of course, there's nothing new in these approaches. Now, I'm not claiming to have, you know, discovered anything new, rather just trying to translate it in a language our left brain or my left brain can understand. And, you know, back to the sleep, just to explain that a little bit more. I mean, yes, again, nothing new in these approaches. And what I did back about 20 years ago, I changed my diet because I knew enough about plant biochemistry, and I thought, well, this has got to make a massive difference. It's basic engineering. If you build and run something on a radically different bunch of compounds, it's going to work differently. Simple as that. So I'd already changed my diet, and then I got interested in what else I could do just to sort of see how it might affect my own personal experiences. And staying awake seemed, you know, there's no prohibition on staying awake as yet. And I thought it would be an interesting combination with a much more natural diet. So I started staying awake myself, probably it was about 1995. I was quite lucky. I had some very interesting experiences early on that convinced me this was a worthwhile area of experimentation. So I did about 3 years of quite a lot of sleep deprivation runs, anything from about 3 days to about 7 days. And perhaps, you know, maybe over 100 experiments in my own time. And they were absolutely fascinating and still are to this day. I still do that kind of stuff from time to time now. And what seems to happen is it really does, it starves the batteries, it starves the ability of the rational mind, my normal sense of self, weakens it, and you go through a window of feeling tired, of course, and irritable, and your speech can begin to slur. Well, of course, we know the left brain seems to be speech dominant. Coordination can become more difficult and so on. So there is a window of dysfunction, if you like. But I think what also happens is the ability of the left side of the brain to maintain its dominance also begins to falter. And usually within 2 to 3 days, it's possible to start getting glimpses of these states that people have alluded to forever. And they're pretty damned amazing. They feel amazing, and there's a fluidity comes. The sleep, the tiredness begins to diminish, believe it or not. Usually 3 to 4 days into these experiments, I found myself being absolutely perplexed. I don't feel tired anymore, and I'm starting to feel really good. And things like my handedness, I'm normally very strongly right-handed, that would change. I was becoming more ambidextrous. I felt like I had more strength and stamina. Of course, I was aware that, you know, self-assessment's very dangerous and sleep deprivation can lead to delusion. So I managed to persuade a university in Manchester to sort of objectively run some tests. And they had me up there. They let me stay awake for 5 days. They were a bit worried I'd perhaps go crazy or maybe even die. So it was limited to 5 days. And I said, well, look, I'd be happy if I stay steady state. If at the end of 5 days my functions are as good as they are on day one, that should be interesting, because all the orthodox literature suggests, you know, a great loss of function, particularly with things like balance and coordination and so on. So we ran the experiment for 5 days. I was filmed. There was always somebody with me, and they were running a battery of tests every 3 hours, different kinds of tests. And it went better than I'd hoped, really. And I've got some of the data online. Basically, all my functions improved, including things like dexterity, test coordination. And interestingly, my left hand, which I've always pondered about handedness in humans. You know, I've often wondered why I have this kind of clumsy left hand that never does quite what I want it to, and it's not as delicate and dexterous and so on. Well, it seemed to catch up and overtake my right hand to some degree, and it turned out to be faster than my right hand. It's a lot of these tests. So again, some physical changes that were moving in the direction that was highly unexpected. In fact, the people running this study, initially they said they'd publish it, probably to demonstrate the level of delusion I was suffering. But once the results were coming through, clear something strange was going on, and suddenly the publishing idea went out the window, and there was talk of, well, we'll have to do this again, but we haven't got any money, and so on and so forth. So unfortunately, I've never had the resources to repeat it, but the data, the sum raw data that still exists, and it points to something strange going on when you combine a diet that is in accordance with our evolutionary origins, and then you stay awake. Well, something strange happens, and that's exactly what some of the, you know, the yogis and so on were talking about. Eat a natural diet, employ some of these techniques, and something magical starts to happen. Of course, it sounds like a bunch of nonsense to the rational mind today, but actually the mechanisms are there that might just make sense of this.
Right. Can you describe these states in any way for us? I mean, I know it's difficult, isn't it? But, you know, was there this kind of spiritual loss of identity and the oceanic feeling, you know, like the Maslow's peak experiences and so on, all have very similar descriptions, don't they?
Sure. Yes.
Get that, well, kind of thing. Share it with us if you can.
Yeah, I'll do my best. I mean, it is difficult to describe, and I always feel a bit clumsy with, you know, my vocabulary is not the best in the world. So trying to find ways to describe something that is wholly other is quite tricky. I'd go as far as saying yes. I mean, some of these states certainly seem to resonate with what other people have reported, and yes, you know. Trying to find the words, certainly profound in essence, feeling at times like, you know, I think in some of the more intense experiences, it's almost like part of me was observing this, that perhaps the part of me that's normally totally in charge was in the back room just watching or something. And I, at times I wondered if it was possible to die from an endorphin overdose. I'd feel so intensely, you know, it was like a peak orgasmic state and some, and it just wouldn't stop. You know, some of this, sometimes this went on for hours. It, of course, absolutely compelling and fascinating. I mean, I remember one occasion where I ended up, I'd been awake, I think, for 2 or 3 days, and this switchover is the best way I can describe it, kicked in perhaps earlier than I expected. And I remember lying, I was just kind of initially incapacitated because of the intensity of the pleasure. I was just lying there totally, my whole, you know, every cell in my body was screaming in sort of some kind of extreme ecstasy. Very pleasant experience, obviously.
Right. You know, what about a residual, Tony? Is there much left when you come down from these states? I mean, does it inform the rest of your life? Like some people, you know, they've taken LSD and it blew their mind so much, their understanding of reality shifted, and they never went back to how they were. Do you get a residual from what you're talking about?
Yes, I think two things. Those experiences totally turned everything upside down. I mean, the reason we're having this conversation is I spent the next 20 years trying to figure it all out and repeating some of the experiments and so on. So it totally changed my whole rational approach to my priorities in my life, in the classic sense. Yes, nothing was ever the same. But it did leave and does leave. I think, I mean, a lot of it is about repetition. I think that even in the milder forms of approaches, there's not many people turn up, meditate once and have a profound experience. It's usually about repetition and discipline, and it can take quite a while for these states to begin to emerge. I don't think it's any different with the more powerful approaches. You might be able to dip your toes in a bit deeper, a bit more quickly, but it's the repetition where you begin, instead of just being blown away and going, oh my God, that was an amazing experience, you begin to sort of navigate the experience when you're in it, and actually there's a whole landscape there that's at least for me anyway, was totally new. I wasn't familiar with it, but with time and practice, you begin to be able to sort of navigate your way around it. And I think with that practice, then in more normal states, you can still tap in a little bit. I wouldn't say I certainly haven't found a way to stay in those states permanently. But it certainly got easier to get into those states, and there would be a residual experience, you know, it'd be like a reverberation, a feel-good factor, perhaps more, my mind worked differently. I mean, it's, you know, time will tell whether what I've come up with has any validity, but the theory itself, the curiosity was there, but the theory and the detail has largely come out of those altered states. You know, the insights and piecing the jigsaw together didn't come from my rational mind. I'm just not sharp enough to do that. But in those states, I'd see things very differently. It's like seeing everything all at once, but it was coherent. I could make sense of it. It wasn't overwhelming. And with practice, I could pull that back through into my rational mind and try and translate it into a way that made sense. So I'd say the last 20 years has been totally about those experiences, and still is today. Yeah, nothing's ever been the same again.
Right. Listen, that's one of the things I've enjoyed in this series, Tony, is linking, you know, what some experts are saying with other experts. And I know in your book you address the subject of music and how that can alter consciousness. We had a wonderful speaker about 6 weeks ago, my friend Gary Malkin. He's an Emmy Award-winning composer, composes film music and stuff, but also music to alter consciousness.
Yeah.
That's a very right brain thing, isn't it, music? How does that work?
I'd say a lot of these things fit into similar categories. You know, trying to get into these states, you're either looking at inhibiting the left side of the brain by whatever technique, stimulating the right side, or combinations of both. And it's helped by some kind of engineering rebuild, which again kind of makes sense if we're in poor shape. And I think music, particularly complex music, flowing music, is beyond the neural, the cognitive, whatever, the perceptual capacity of the left brain. Now, remember, I'm saying it's actually reverted to a more primitive type, which is a harsh thing to say, but then I have one, so I can get away with saying that. It's not very musical. It doesn't, you know, it's not very complex in any of its abilities. So these more complex musical forms, totally, it just washes over. It doesn't react at all. In order to hear that kind of music, you have to borrow more function from the right brain, or it will stimulate the right brain. And I think that's why music has been such a part of these traditions. You often have a hypnotic beat, something to keep the left brain happy, because it's easily, you know, it's easily sort of engaged with a very simple beat. It can follow beat fine, but if you really want to engage the right brain, you want something much more complex. And I think there's echoes even in the kind of early rave movement, quite complex music, often with some kind of neurochemical stimulation, and dance, often very flowing movement, not rigid movement. Well, the left brain can't do that. You know, I couldn't sing to save my life in my normal state, and I'd feel incredibly terrified to do so. But my voice certainly does change in these altered states, and the music sounds, instead of music sounding, oh, well, yeah, that's quite nice, it becomes all-encompassing. You almost feel like you become the music, and it's profound and ecstatic. And I think music almost acts like a tuning fork. You know, if you find the right kind of form of music, it will stimulate that function in the right brain and bring it more to the fore, and it pulls through all these other traits, so you start feeling very, very different. Well, you're moving more to a right brain dominant state, and music is a very powerful technique to do that.
Right, it is true, isn't it? I know that if you damage the, you know, significantly physically damage left brain, so that a person loses their speech ability, that person can still sing, and even sing with words, which I think is quite amazing, actually.
Yes, again, well, you know, a classic idea, the left brain has decided speech is one of its crowning glories. I'm not saying everybody buys into that, but that's certainly often what you see in the popular sort of press. And yet, typically, certainly past puberty, at least, the left brain is pretty awful at singing. Yet the right brain, it seems, can sing. So what are the origins of speech? Is left brain speech just a dumbed down form of singing? And you're quite right. You know, there's never, I've yet to come across any cases where people have had significant damage to their right hemisphere, where suddenly people have turned out to be phenomenal musicians or they can sing. It's always the other way around. There's a pattern there that the really good stuff only comes if you damage the left brain in such a way it loses some control, and then you get you tap into this. And as you say, there's an ability to sing, you know, to sing. And there's some cases where people have, you know, learned to talk again. And in fact, one of my early experiences, just briefly, if we've got time, one of my very early sleep deprivation experiences, I think I was lucky, but it was quite bizarre, where I ended up in a state where I felt paralyzed down my right-hand side. My right arm had pins and needles, my right leg, all down that right side. My left side felt very fluidic. I could move it, but I couldn't speak. I had no speech initially. And, of course, I could have been quite frightened, but in that state, I was very calm, and I thought, well, you know, it felt interesting, and I wasn't thinking in words. I'm narrating this now in words because I have no choice. And after about maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and with some effort, I found my voice again. It took a while, and my voice sounded very different. I had a friend in the room who knew me quite well, and I you know, I was speaking, but from a very different place. My voice sounded different. It was very poetic, but very communicative. So I think there is a parallel communication system, but normally we don't get access to it. We're stuck with this kind of fairly monotone thing that exchanges concepts and thinks they're real, and that's currently where the left brain's at. It's not really cutting edge at all.
There's just one thing I think we should add, though, just really to make the point that it's not all that simple, is it? It is very complex. There are many examples of left brain damage leading to things like really florid schizophrenia, you know, not exactly paradise and godlike abilities on the right side. It can go horribly wrong just shutting down the left. So presumably it's doing something there.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, talking about shutting down the left and so on, I'm looking at this from a perspective that we're in deep, deep trouble here. So I'm looking for clues as to make sense of this, and is there a way back? I'm not suggesting we should ever have operated with the shut down left hemisphere, though I suspect that might be less problematic than a damaged left hemisphere, because if it's still perceptually dominant, all you're going to have is a left hemisphere that's even more dysfunctional than average, hence the problems. So it's just the case where sometimes damage can lead to glimpses. I think that's all it is. It's just glimpses. But of course, damage can lead to dysfunction, which is what you'd expect. So yes, it's not just as simple as some damage is going to lead to anything wonderful. Occasionally it does, and it's always left damage opens up the door to something else.
Yeah, yeah. Tony, you've been great. I want people to be able to connect with you, to, you know, download your book and so on. Give us some links, places on the web that people can go, and I can repeat these.
Sure, yeah. Obviously, we can only touch on this subject. It's such, you know, it's 20 years of stuff, really, so I hope it's whetted people's appetite. But, yeah, there is a lot of information online. There's two sites, really. There's Left in the Dark. There's www.leftinthedark.org.uk. There's sort of quite a lot of information on there, and papers and stuff to download. And then the sister site, which has a little bit more pictorial information, it's perhaps a bit easier to follow for some people. That's Beyond Belief. That's www.beyond-belief.org.uk. And again, a different perspective telling the same story. There is a book. I'd say it's an outline. There's still a lot of data that could be filled in, but it provides a good outline, I think. And that's Left in the Dark, and you can get that at Amazon, or you can get it on the Left in the Dark site.
Right, Tony, you've been great, absolutely fascinating, and a totally different spin on the things that we've been talking about, you know. And I think it's great. I'm trying to bring a whole picture about the science of being and consciousness, and your contribution is massive, really. It goes in a completely different direction. And I very much appreciate the time that you've spent coming and talking to us. I hope a lot of people will connect with you and help you advance your theories. I think that you're connected with something else now. My left brain has gone a bit foggy today. I probably need some more caffeine. But a site for people who want to work on, you have to fill me in here, want to get together researching consciousness and so on. Do you know what I'm talking about? Because if so, fill me in.
Say that again, a site that what, sorry?
Yeah, a collection of people who are wanting to get together and research consciousness. I think some time ago I was on that, or connected with your site anyway.
Oh, right. It could be, yeah, I did have a site up for a while. I think it was obviously the rather predictable site. It might have been Choose Right Now. It was a site that had some problems. It's going to relaunch again, I'm hoping sometime in the next month, but the idea was to draw people together who are interested in the possibility that our neural system isn't as functional as we'd like to think, and you know, looking at how to move things forward. But that site's currently down. I'm hoping it's going to be up, as I say, roughly in a month or so. So I'll mention it now if that's the site you're talking about.
I don't think it was. International Center of Consciousness. It's just come to me.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's neural.net, isn't it? Which is a clever.
Oh, I see. I'm with you now. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was so. I should have written it down, then I could have brought it to you.
Yeah, no.
But anyway,
I was a bit lost. But yeah. Sorry.
Are you connected with that personally?
No, I'm not. I mean, I've written an email pretty much everybody over the last 20 years, but it's perhaps only in the last 5 years or so where I've managed to get my own theory coherent enough for me to understand, let alone anybody else. That I'm starting to get a lot more interest. So. Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly in touch with people, but obviously what I'm proposing is somewhat challenging because on the one hand, I'm driven by the idea of solutions, but I can't see how we can start getting to solutions if we don't have an accurate diagnosis. And while there are many, many people looking at, you know, ideas of evolving and things that can help, I'm taking quite a harsh view and saying, no, we've crashed severely here. There's a serious problem, which is in accordance with the ancient traditions. And until we take that on board, you know, if there's a serious problem in our perceptual equipment, we'd be chasing our tails forever. We won't even know what questions to ask, let alone find appropriate solutions. And not everybody initially wants to hear that, but I think with what's going on in the world today, it's becoming an easier sell to suggest that there's something seriously amiss here. It's not just about expecting us to behave wonderfully better, because we've been expecting that of ourselves for thousands of years, and yet here we are, and we've had access to techniques for thousands of years, from meditation to use of neurochemical analogs and so on, and still here we are. So I'm not sure these approaches that are being touted around today really can cut it anymore. You know, I think the condition is much more severe, and that initially is quite shocking, but it also opens up the door to, you know, if the causal problem is a neurological problem, challenging though that is, it brings it back to a human scale fix. And we already know an awful lot about the micro structure of the brain, the molecular regime of the brain. If you change it just a little bit, you get a massive impact on perception and state of mind. Things, you know, again, I'm not suggesting for a second that this is about a deficiency in things like MDMA, for example, but we know that people who are very aggressive, very violent, once they had access to some of these chemicals, massive transformation. And to me, there's almost a taboo around this area. We'll do anything but look at the structure, which seems to, of course, I'm not saying we are a structure, but it seems to facilitate the music we play as ourselves. Why we won't look at the structure? We almost legislate against any change in structure while we expect massive change in behavior. Well, we've got it all back to front. Tiny changes in structure, as long as they're judicious and we know what we're doing, guaranteed will make a massive difference in our behavior and perception. And the evolutionary data is saying we've lost this, you know, this incredibly complex cocktail of chemicals. There's no argument there. Nobody's saying, no, we didn't come, at least not in the orthodox picture anyway. We came from the forest. We were flooded with a massive cocktail of chemicals. Now we're not. These are very basic proposals. And it's a case of saying, well, is it worth looking at the possibility that maybe we needed those chemicals to function properly? Because, the neural system is a drug machine. It cannot operate without a very complex cocktail of drugs, and we've lost the richest cocktail that, you know, that the biological evolution has ever produced. That's what we ran on. Now we don't, and look at our behavior. Maybe there's a connection there. Is it worth at least looking at?
Right, and I think I know. I mean, I don't want to launch on another long section, but I know you'd say probably part of that is that we're now cooking our food and botching all the chemicals up anyway. That Roy's
it's another whole area, and obviously, you know, I cover these things in the book and on the website. I could probably chat about this for hours, as you know. But yes, I mean, I think cooking is about molecular restructuring. That's why we do it often to often to make things that we can't eat, which is interesting, something edible. But that is changing massively the molecular structure of what we build. You know, our neural system is considered by many to be the most complex molecular structure we know. And we've massively changed its basic design, its basic construction materials, and its neurochemical fuel within the last quarter of a million years, and even within the last few thousand years, and certainly even within the last 50 to 100 years, massively, massively changed that. And if, again, if you went to engineering class 101 and said, oh, you can change all these parameters on your lawnmower and it will work the same, you'd be thrown out for being an idiot. You know, and our neural system is vastly more complex and vastly more sensitive. You know, we can take things like Prozac and it alters our mood. Well, what on earth are we doing? You know, we're defending this impoverished neurochemical environment while we wage war on ourselves.
Strong message, Tony. Anyway, as I said, it's been totally fascinating. It's barely plumbing the touching the surface. There's depths there. Folks, go to his website and read some more. I can highly recommend it. Just give us the links again one more time, Tony, then we'll say goodbye.
Yep, will do. Yeah, the two main sites are leftinthedark.org.uk, and then the other site, again, perhaps a little bit easier to navigate for some people, it's beyond-belief.org.uk. And as I say, my primary objective is trying to get people to ask different questions. I'm not saying I've got all the answers, but I would say in a sane world, we should really be checking the functionality of our neural system. It shouldn't be threatening. It shouldn't be a problem. We should be bringing this thing in for a health check every 5-10 years. There shouldn't be any resistance. And once you start asking, is there a problem? Oh, my God, it starts getting quite scary.
Tony, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks very much.